You off right there, but we're running out of time. Mr. Masoud Shajare, chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission from London, and also Mr. Saeb Shaath, author and a West Asia expert from Belfast. Thanks for joining us on this edition of The Spotlight.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah,
who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Call of Islam page will welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atal, the host of this program. With me in the studio, we have a special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Rouhani. Assalamu alaikum, Shaykh. Welcome to the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
All right, Shaykh Rouhani, for today's discussion, we want to talk about an ayah in the Quran. There are some misconceptions or misunderstandings about the meaning of this Quran and the concept. That is Surah An-Nisa, ayah 34, which starts with Ar-Rijalu Qawwamuna, or Ar-Rijalu Qawwamuna ala An-Nisa. In fact, roughly, it could be translated as the men are the managers of the women. We can say, some people might say that why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in this ayah says that men are the managers of the women? What is the main reason? And is there any continuation to this ayah? And what is the main content of ayah 34 of Surah An-Nisa?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If you want to better understand this ayah, we have to understand the world view of Islam. Mm-hmm. Regarding the position and status of men and women in the family. According to the Islamic anthropology, since men and women are different in terms of creation, This difference in terms of creation, either physical and bodily differences, as well as spiritually and mentally differences, are there. Since we have two different creatures, as men and women, as mother and father, as brother and sister, as daughter and son, in a family, then of course the, let's say, conditions, characteristics, situations, environments for these two should be different. Because, for example, man is more powerful physically, and he has to take the responsibilities more in terms of, let's say, power of man.
Yes.
And then women and mother should live in a peaceful environment, and he should be provided with the things that she needs so that she would be able to train and to bring up the children in a peaceful, in a, let's say, a peaceful environment, in a peaceful way, with lots of, for example, love and mahabba and kindness and mercy to the children.
Yes.
So that's why this responsibility for mother is really, really significant. Then mother should not go out, should not work hard and difficultly, with difficulties,
yes,
in a challenging kind of environment.
Mm-hmm.
Because she is not able to tolerate, to bear those kind of things, difficulties and hardships in those kind of environments.
Yes.
That is why it is the duty of father to go out and to work and,
yes,
to provide the family, the,
yes,
children, the mother, with all the facilities they need.
Yes.
So why? Because the future of these children, future of this daughter and son that is going to be brought up by this mother is very,
yes,
much significant.
Yes.
Because they are the things that they are the children on which you invest the whole life.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, you should have a very fruitful life. What is the fruit of this life is those children. So how can you bring up good children if you provide them with a peaceful kind of environment?
Yes.
With a peaceful house, with a peaceful family, and in a way that mother should express, mother must be able to express her love to the babies, to the children.
That's right.
So that in the future they will love each other, they will love mankind, they will care about others, they will love, for example, the other, let's say, friends of them. If they do not receive if the children do not receive any kind of kindness, compassion, or let's say, love and mahabba in their childhood, how can they in the future express any kind of love and mahabba to the others?
Mm-hmm.
How can you have a very peaceful, a very beautiful, a very merciful kind of society in the,
yes,
future? Then, of course, if you bring up your children in that kind of lovely environment, of course, in the future, your society will be full of love and mercy and kindness.
That's right.
And you have a very beautiful kind of society. Mm-hmm. Suppose that mother and father, both of them go outside and work hardly outside in the physical kind of hardships, facing physical hardships, then when at the end of the day when both of them came to the home,
yes,
none of them can tolerate the babies, none of them,
yes,
can tolerate the children, none of them will be able to express any kind of love, mm-hmm, and mercy and mahabba to the children, then how, what kind of children, what kind of brutal, merciless, violent children they would be in the future?
Mm-hmm.
As we see, unfortunately, nowadays in the modern world, in the modern societies,
yes,
they themselves confirm and confess,
yeah,
that our children, our young generations, are not caring about anyone.
Mm-hmm.
No one. You know, for example, there's a homeless person who is about to die. Tens of hundreds and thousands of people passing him. No one care about him.
Mm-hmm.
No one show any kind of expressing no kind of compassion, love and mercy and muhabba to that man because they didn't,
yes,
receive that.
Okay.
They are not trained. They are not brought up in that kind of society. No mother, no father, no,
yes,
brother, no sister, no aunt, no grandmother, grandfather. None of them were there in the childhood of this child to show him any kind of respect, any kind of, let's say, love and mahabba.
That's right.
That's why
so,
it is.
So this qawamun ala nisa by rajal is,
yeah,
managing
life
right.
in a
okay.
way that they should have a very good, a very, uh-huh, let's say, supportive or let's say helpful kind of, mm-hmm, generation in the future. This is very much important.
Because some people might say that the rights of the women are violated in this ayah. No, it is not so.
It gives more responsibilities put more responsibilities on the shoulders of men.
Men, yes.
But at the same time, it doesn't mean that women has no responsibility. Mother,
yes,
has, again, a very significant, very important responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
Both are there.
That's all right.
The media portrays Muslim women as oppressed. They are forced into praying 5 times a day, and subsequently they wear the veil, or as we Muslims call it, the hijab, which they are also forced to do, and they have silent voices. What a preposterous introduction! How can people judge these women? What a preposterous idea! It's ridiculous. The media portrays them as oppressed. Who gave the media the authority over Islam? All hijabi women do is practice their religion. It's not hurting anybody, it's not harming anybody, but yet ignorant people label them as outcasts. Do you know how hard it is to be a white rose in a bouquet of red roses? How hard it is to be the only one doing right in the midst of so many people who are doing wrong? To be the only one practicing your religion in loads of people who don't even have a religion. So what the media is saying is that anyone who is constantly praying is oppressed. Anyone who has God in their mind 24/7 is oppressed. And anyone who lives a life of solitude, alone, doesn't even look at men is oppressed. Hold up. I haven't actually described a Muslim woman at all. I've actually described a nun. So now you're saying a nun is oppressed? No? Why is it okay for a nun to become from head to toe in order to devote herself to God, and she is noble and everyone respects her? But when a Muslim woman does the same, they say she needs to be liberated. This is a double standard. So the next time you see a Muslim woman in school, in work, on the street, wherever, do not pity her. Do not look down on her. And most of all, do not think she is less privileged or has less freedom than you. Hijabi women are not caged. They're not repressed and they're not silent. In contrast, wearing hijab gives them a voice. It gives them an identity and it makes them stand out. Think about that.
And in some parts of the ayah, you know, we can say that because the terms are also used that, for example, if the woman disobeys the men are obliged to do so and so and so.
It has different interpretations. You know, we have to go to see that what kind of interpretation we can understand or we can accept from this ayah. But one point that that I can mention here is that if we compare a pure Muslim society or Islamic society with a modern non-Islamic society, I am 100% sure that in this pure Muslim society, you may not find any homeless people. Any poor people to the level that they were about to die and no one helped them. Because we have sadaqat, we have charities, we have nafaqat, we have all different kinds of means that all Muslims, even they themselves are poor, they will help, they will support each other, they will provide each other with facilities they need. But in modern societies, we do not see such kind of things. So that's why it seems that the model that Islam tells us, the model of training or the method of training that is mentioned in Islam is a better kind of system, a better kind of method.
It is full of peace and full of reconciliation between the wife and husband and the children. All in all, we could say that the main pillar of the family is considered to be the men and the men of the society. Nowadays, some of the feminist movements are after, for example, the rights of the women. They believe that the women can do the same work or the workload as the men do. What do you think about that? I think this ayah helped them very much to be respected more, isn't it?
You know, that is not a good idea because look at the output or the outcome of these kind of ideas in the modern societies.
Yes.
Now, for example, in some of these modern societies, 90%, maybe 95% of women, they do not want to get married anymore. And there is no any children. There is no any new generation in these societies. You know, the immigrants from Africa, from Asia, they are being replaced by the original people of these let's say cities in the modern world. You know, this is because if you tell the women that you have to go work outside like men, of course they will be unable to give birth to the new children. Mm-hmm. They will never do that. Then what will happen to you, to your society, to your nation?
Even the women are working more than men, you know?
Yeah, but, and also they are physically not as powerful as men.
Yes.
Yeah, it would have lots of consequences for the ladies.
Mm-hmm. Okay, lots of consequences.
Particularly mentally, because they will be disrespected, they will be misused, they will be harassed in those environments. As you see, if you go to the statistics, they see that in the army, in the offices, in the workplaces, how many numberless, let's say, ladies are disrespected, humiliated, misused, you know? These are the things that will happen. Then mentally also they will face lots of challenges and problems, as well as physically. Then they will lose all the power to bring any kind of children.
That's all right. Okay. Thank you very much. As we said, the religion of Islam has emphasized very much on the solidarity of the family foundation, you know, the parents with the help of each other must establish a peaceful atmosphere for the growth of the children, because these children are going to be the next generation. They themselves are going to get married, become the parents. So all in all, when they say قَوَّامُونَ عَلَى النِّسَاءِ, this قَوَّام is going, and this power is going to be given to both men and women inside the family, and it is not over, we can't say anybody. And the managerial position and the custodianship of the families are given to the men to work outside, you know, to earn their living, and the women to take care of the affairs inside the house. Of course, in Islam, the women are also allowed to work outside, to be sociable to society and be active part of the society. But inside the house, the managerial position is given to the men. That's right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding Ayah 34 of Surah An-Nisa, Ayatul Ar-Rijal Qawwamuna ala An-Nisa. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min Ali wa Hussein لعلي وحسين وحسان إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسان لعلي وحسين وحسان كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
يوسف جلالي بتهران
روباشافت غازا
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Гармати, ефективні системи.
The top annual analysis of global arms sales found that France has risen to the number two weapons exporter in the world. The gains have often been made thanks to debt from Ukraine, which has become Europe's largest arms importer. French arms sales have soared 50% in recent years and now comprise 11% of the global market. The world's leading arms dealer is still the United States, which controls a record 42% of the global weapons trade. Arms sales to Ukraine has proven to be big business, and it may explain President Emmanuel Macron's about-face on the conflict. 2 years ago, Macron warned that Russia must not be humiliated, but he's recently become one of Europe's leading anti-Russia war hawks. France's top three arms clients are India, which is the world's largest arms importer, followed by Saudi Arabia and tiny but rich Qatar. Africa is still reeling from 40 tons of illegal free arms drops France made in 2011 to support anti-Gaddafi rebels in Libya. As predicted, the weapons soon found their way to Syria, the Central African Republic, Ukraine, and elsewhere. This week, French Parliament approved a 10-year military pact with Kiev, which guarantees billions in more weapons deliveries. Russia continues to gain ground against NATO-backed Ukraine, which is an important reminder that some weapons are made to work under actual wartime conditions, and some are made mainly for sales and profit. Ramin Mazaheri, Paris.
An unprecedented global movement gaining momentum. Initiated by veteran French lawyer and academic Gilles Devers, the Army of Lawyers for Palestine now has over 200,000 lawyers of different nationalities on board and still counting as he travels from country to country to promote his grassroots campaign.
We are witnessing a new movement in the world. The atrocities committed in Gaza are no longer only a matter that concerns Muslim countries. Far from it. Here we have a French lawyer that has started an initiative that brought together 300 lawyers from across the world in less than 10 days, and that number grew rapidly to 100,000. And now with the MOU that we have signed at the Iran Judiciary Bar, that number will be rising to 50,000 lawyers. With Iran on board, you can also expect lawyers from Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon to join in as well.
And an optimistic Gilles Devers, who has already filed a complaint of genocide against Israel with the International Criminal Court, demanding an arrest warrant for top Israeli politicians, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
This is going to be a tough battle, without a doubt. But in just a few months, all these lawyers have joined us. This kind of solidarity is unprecedented. We have never seen so many lawyers join hands for one purpose in history. So this is a great sign, because it won't be enough to tell a judge, look, there's no many of us. Instead, we have to be able to defend Palestine with strong legal arguments. And by the looks of things, we have a solid base for that.
His South African fellow companion shedding light on the legal aspects of the matter while explaining how the case brought to the International Court of Justice by South Africa is also paving the way.
The ICJ order specifically spoke about creating a humanitarian corridor and a humanitarian assistance to the people of Gaza. The United States and Israel were saying that the word ceasefire did not exist in the ICJ order. But this is not true, because the humanitarian aid on the ground at scale cannot be delivered without an effective and immediate ceasefire.
It is very clear that we are witnessing a birth of new age. A new movement of justice-seeking people from all over the world is emerging, and that is why, while the South African government files a complaint, we see a grassroots movement also taking shape. A very unique one that has brought together lawyers who are seeking justice in the battle between good and evil.
And in the words of these legal experts, this goal is not far from reach. Lawyers believe that we live in a new era in which this new global initiative will eventually lead to justice for Palestinians. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
An annual meeting of Quran reciters and memorizers with the leader of the Islamic Revolution.
Every year on the first day of the holy month of Ramadan, leader of the Islamic Revolution receives top reciters of the Holy Quran to stress the importance of this very holy book in the lives of Muslims.
In the meeting, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei described the recitation of the Quran as a sacred art, while underlining that the primary objective of this very valuable skill should be to convey the meaning and message of the Quran to the public and society and create the ground for contemplation of the Holy Scripture. Elsewhere in his speech, Ayatollah Khamenei expressed his satisfaction with the abundant number of young Quran reciters in the country, viewing their increase as a blessing of the Islamic Revolution. Meanwhile, referring to the crimes committed by the Zionist regime in Gaza, the leader pointed out that the peak of resilience that is being witnessed in Gaza presently stems from a profound familiarity with and adherence to the teachings of the Quran. Before the meeting, young and experienced reciters and memorizers were very much excited to listen and take a glimpse of the leader.
I am very much excited to recite some verses of the Holy Quran in the presence of the leader. But this is a great opportunity for me to see the leader.
This is the third time I have the honor of attending such a great event. Today I am going to have supplications to recite about the holy month of Ramadan.
Other reciters were worried about the people of Gaza who are observing the holy month of Ramadan amid the Israeli bombing and shelling campaign.
The month of Ramadan is the month of mercy and blessing. I do believe that during this month, the Zionist regime will face a big defeat.
At the end of the ceremony, the Quran reciters and memorizers held congregational prayers led by the leader of the Islamic Revolution and broke their fast together. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran, Russia, and China have conducted the main phase of a joint naval drill dubbed Maritime Security Belt 2024. After arriving at the northern part of the Indian Ocean, the vessels of the three countries practiced different operations. The joint drills took place in 17,000 square kilometers of water in a region that is an internationally crucial hub for energy and trade traffic. The first phase of the naval drills included live firing at designated surface targets in the Sea of Oman. Various vessels and fast attack crafts from the IRGC were also involved in the exercise. The vessels were armed with the state-of-the-art homegrown advanced weapons. The next phase included the Photo X exercise and offensive formations. The helicopters of the Islamic Republic of Iran Navy and the IRGC monitored the region in all stages of the exercise. Iran's Navy commander hailed the exercise as a successful endeavor to improve maritime cooperation of the contributing countries. The commander also said that Iran expects the drills to expand in the future.
This year, as we expected, regarding the types of vessels participating in the exercise, both China and Russia have increased the variety as well as tonnage of the vessels. So hopefully, we expect more countries to join the drills in the future, especially regional states.
Admiral Irani also stated that regional nations have the capacity to confront piracy and terrorism by enhancing cooperation. The exercises are the latest in joint drills by Iran, China, and Russia. Iran says regional countries are most welcome to take part in the drills that are going to take place in the future. The Islamic Republic has time and again stressed that regional countries are the ones that are truly in charge of establishing security in the region. Mahdi Abbasian, Konarak.
On the first day of the holy month of Ramadan in Nigeria, the Islamic movement held a rally through the streets of the capital, Abuja, in a peaceful protest against the massacre of innocent civilians in Gaza. The protest march took the demonstrators to the gate of the United States Embassy, where they sat down and submitted a letter of protest condemning the Israeli genocide in Gaza and U.S. involvement in the killing of innocent Palestinians.
America is one of the major party in this killing of innocent female and children in Gaza. Since October 7th to date, they have killed 31,000, more than 31,000 innocent people, majorly female and children in Gaza.
The demonstrators blame the United States and British governments for using their influence to block a UN resolution calling for a ceasefire. They said every decent government has condemned the Israeli terror attacks on the Palestinians, but the US government has continued to support the mass murder of innocent Palestinians.
They are killing female and children. They are imposing starvation on innocent female and children. Babies have been seen under rubble, crying inside blood. we see a lot of fathers carrying a lifeless body of their children killed by Israelis. Anybody that has concern for humanity should come out today on the street and show his solidarity with Palestinians.
The demonstrators burned the U.S. and Israeli flags as they slammed Tel Aviv's regime impunity and the silence of the international community. Many Muslims in Nigeria believe that Israel's continuous killing of Palestinians in Gaza on the eve of the holy month of Ramadan is a clear proof of the regime's disrespect for Islamic sanctities. The protesters here are urging world leaders to pressure Israel to end the massacre in Gaza. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Britons treat their National Health Service, better known as the NHS, with an almost religious reverence.
We grew up using the NHS from the cradle to the grave, free at the point of use, and that has tremendous significance for our lives.
But today, this eternal source of national pride is under increased scrutiny, with new figures showing more than 120,000 people died last year in England alone from delays in life-saving treatment. The NHS is a state-funded healthcare system founded in 1948. Back then, it cost around $20 billion in today's money to run. Last year, the government spent more than $181 billion. Despite that, more than 7 million people are now on the waiting list in England alone. That's nearly 12% of the population having to wait at least 52 weeks for a health consultation.
Our politicians aren't really serving the public interest. They are serving a neoliberal agenda, which is to transfer the country's natural assets and wealth to overseas corporations like United Health of America and other big multinationals.
The government has promised to cut the long queues, but has made little progress. The situation is no better in the rest of the kingdom. In Scotland and Northern Ireland, 1 in 80 people, and in Wales, 1 in 20 are having to wait more than a year for treatment. There's also the energy costs and inflation that has reduced the value of the NHS budget, meaning it now has to do more with significantly less. Add to the mix a shortage of staff, which means more pressure on exhausted employees.
We've had more than a decade of defunding since the financial crash. This has led to a real terms wage cut for staff. The whole population, the health needs have gone up. We have trouble keeping hold of staff, and we've also lost significant capacity with the NHS through privatisation. So we don't have enough beds, we don't have enough staff, and the staff we do have are being treated appallingly.
The health service is also coping with an aging population. A large number of people now live with chronic conditions like heart disease and diabetes. The COVID-19 pandemic severely tested the NHS, with its aftermath still posing serious challenges. Health officials and experts warn for the UK's National Health Service to survive, the next government should declare it a national emergency. Saipur is at London.
India says it will enact the Citizenship Amendment Act that provides fast-track naturalization for multiple religious groups who fled to India from Afghanistan, Bangladesh and Pakistan before 2014. The law, however, excludes Muslims from those countries. Back in 2019, law's approval sparked deadly protests across the country and was halted since. The Muslim minority in India fears the government is using this law and other similar laws to widen crackdown on them.
India introduced this bill in 2016 with the aim of granting citizenship to what it calls a persecuted section of refugees. However, the bill has become one of the most controversial issues across the country since it excludes Muslims from availing citizenship. Critics accuse the ruling BJP of targeting a particular community on the basis of faith, which experts call unconstitutional.
Commentators also question the exclusion of persecuted religious minorities from other regions such as Tibet, Sri Lanka and Myanmar. India's Interior Ministry has said in a statement, those eligible can now apply online for Indian citizenship. The issue has been one of the key pledges of Indian Prime Minister since assuming office in 2014. The new legislation makes changes to more than six decades old Indian citizenship law.
It's unfortunate for us that we are not part of this new law, despite the fact we have faced worse persecution any community has faced so far. We have still hope one day India will accept us on the ground of humanity.
Opposition political parties have accused the ruling party of influencing the elections, saying the move is to polarize the voters, considering its timing. More than 200 petitions challenging the law are still pending before the court of law.
We thank India they provide us shelter. It's an act of kindness, but we urge this country not to abandon us, knowing the fact we have seen deadly violence and persecution.
India, home to roughly 200 million Muslims, have recently seen targeted attacks and vicious hate campaigns. Critics accuse the ruling party of mixing religion with politics, resonating with India's majority. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Russia Navy warship, Russia Navy warship, and China Navy warship. This is Iranian Navy warship 235. I call you on channel 16. Do you read me? Over.
The Maritime Security Belt 2024 has officially kicked off with Russian and Chinese vessels entering Iran's territorial waters south of the country on Tuesday. The naval and airborne units of Iran's army and the IRGC, along with their Chinese and Russian counterparts, will participate in various operations during this exercise. Naval delegations from Azerbaijan, Pakistan, Kazakhstan, Oman and South Africa have also taken part as observer states. At the first stage of the drill, the naval officers of the three countries as well as the observer states reviewed different phases of the exercise on maps and held tactical briefings. Later, the naval commanders of Iran, Russia and China held a joint presser. The Iranian Navy's deputy commander said the main aim of the joint exercise is to help safeguard security in the northern part of the Indian Ocean.
Upholding peace and security in the north of Indian Ocean and having a specialized cooperation in combating piracy and terrorism in our region are among the main goals of this exercise. We are constantly working to improve this cooperation.
Meanwhile, Chinese and Russian Navy commanders said the joint exercise further demonstrates the preparedness of the participating countries to maintain security while also deepening their practical cooperation. 2024 is the fifth consecutive year that the Islamic Republic of Iran's Navy is hosting countries participating in the Maritime Security Belt drills in the northern Indian Ocean region. This year's naval drills have kicked off under the motto Together for Peace and Security, with participating countries highlighting the importance of jointly safeguarding regional security. Atiya Bosyan, Konarak.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. One of the key buts on the reported factors of the unwavering U.S. support for the Zionist regime's genocidal war on Gaza is the overwhelming presence of Zionist Jews in the Joe Biden administration. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, "These Zionist Jews exert enormous influence in the American power corridors and enjoy unconditional support from the U.S. president, who has on numerous occasions boasted of being a Zionist himself. The presence and influence of Zionist Jews in the White House has always been a point of discussion. However, since the events of October 7th, it has manifested itself in many ways. Biden administration's vetoes of ceasefire resolutions in the UN Security Council, which drew widespread condemnation from pro-Palestine groups, rekindled the debate about the Zionist influence. Raising the issue of dominance of Zionist Jews in the U.S. administration and policy circles is often seen through the prism of anti-Semitism in the West, even though the same people paradoxically like to boast about the disproportionate number of Jews in other fields." The Zionist Jewishness of Biden's cabinet was pointed out recently by The Forward, a progressive media for a Jewish American audience, as well as the Israeli right-wing newspaper Times of Israel. Being a Jew should not be seen as a problem, but those in the Biden administration have clearly exhibited the tendencies of Zionism, not only justifying the Zionist regime's genocide in Gaza, but also lobbying for more financial and military aid to the occupying regime. There are also non-Jewish Zionists whose support is motivated by Christian Zionism or belonging to pro-Israel lobbies, a common case in the ranks of the Republican Party. The problem lies in the fact that everyone in the Biden administration is a radical Zionist who will uncompromisingly justify the Zionist regime's war crimes, with slight disagreements over relatively minor issues, such as illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. In the American mainstream media, voting in the UN Security Council and supporting the genocidal destruction of Gaza is treated as common sense and a natural course of action. Biden made no secret of his Zionist inclinations, uttering the words, "I am a Zionist," and he has proved it through numerous pro-Israeli activities in his decades-long political career. One of them is the placement of Jewish Zionists in top positions in his administration, which at the beginning of 2021 evoked a popular joke on social networks that the West Wing would have a minion. The Hebrew term minion means the minimum number of males required to constitute a representative community of Israel for liturgical purposes. Biden's initial lineup includes Antony Blinken as Secretary of State, Merrick Garland as Attorney General, Avril Haines as Director of National Intelligence, Ronald Klain as White House Chief of Staff, Rachel Levine as Assistant Secretary for Health, Alejandro Mayorkas as Secretary of Homeland Security, and Janet Yellen as Secretary of Treasury. One level down are David Cohen as Deputy CIA Director, Eric Lander as Science and Technology Advisor, and Neuberger as Deputy National Security Advisor, and Wendy Sherman as Deputy Secretary of State. In the meantime, Victoria Nuland took the position of Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs, Ed Siskel as White House counsel, and Klein was replaced by Jeff Zients as Chief of Staff. Others appointed by Biden include Ned Price as a spokesperson for the Department of State, Jennifer Klein as Executive Director of the White House Gender Policy Council, as well as a large number of ambassadors. The Zionist envoys include Michael Alder, David Cohen, Rahem Emanuel, Eric Garcetti, Mark Gainstein, Amy Gutman, Jonathan Kaplan, Yael Lempert, Alan Leventhal, Randy Levine, Jack Liu, Jack Markell, Constance Milstein, Mark Nathanson, Mark Ostfield, David Pressman, Daniel Rosenblum, and Mark Stanley, among others. Blinken, the top American diplomat, comes from a Zionist family. His grandfather, Morris, was one of the early American Zionists and the founder of the American-Palestine Institute in the years before the declaration of the Zionist entity. His institute funded economists to prepare a report on the economic viability of such an entity and lobbied Washington to politically support its creation. Following Blinken's appointment as the top U.S. diplomat, replacing Mike Pompeo, the Zionist regime media praised his and Biden's close relations with Tel Aviv during the Second Intifada in the early 2000s, noting their lifeline support for Israel and its security. During the Obama administration, Blinken often justified Zionist regime's aggressions in the region with the Bakhni phrase, the right to self-defense, and praised Trump for strengthening the Zionist regime's regional alliances. He was a close confidant of the Israeli ambassador to the U.S., Ron Dermer, who could call him in the middle of the night for pro-Israeli services, such as lobbying hard to have Israel's Iron Dome air military system financed with American taxpayer money. In his first days in office, he also made it known that the new Biden administration would support earlier Trump's decision and keep the American embassy to the occupied territories in the occupied Al-Quds. Last year, during the bickering between Biden and Netanyahu, Blinken pledged enduring U.S. ties with the Zionist regime, seeing it as a far more important ally than NATO member Turkey. As for Mayorkas, even the Israeli media boasted of his strong family ties to Tel Aviv and praised him for the data-sharing pact between the United States and the Zionist regime. Even greater Zionist credit for intelligence sharing goes to CIA Deputy Chief David Cohen, whose career under Obama focused on sanctioning Israel's enemies. Thus, it is no surprise that Americans are bankrolling the genocide of Palestinians in Gaza while harping about ceasefire and aid drops to hoodwink the international community.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Salamun alaikum. On the continuation of this program, Lantern, we have a nice story today. Our story entitled, The Guest, is the title of today's story. A father and a son were once guests of Imam Ali, peace be upon him. As they arrived, Imam received them warmly and arranged for their comfortable accommodation. In a room where they were seated, Imam, peace be upon him, sat opposite to them, engaging them in a friendly conversation, and then it was time for the meal. After food had been served and eaten, Qanbar, Imam's servant, brought a basin and a pitcher full of water for washing the guests' hands. Imam took the pitcher himself and asked the father to extend his hands so that he would pour the water. "How is it possible that my Imam served me? It should be other way," the guest said. Imam Ali said, "Here is your brother in faith, eager to serve his brother and to earn the pleasure of Allah. Why do you prevent him?" But the guest hesitated. Finally, Imam said, "As your Imam, I request that you allow me the honor of this service." And when the guest complied, Imam said, "Let your hands be washed thoroughly. Do not hasten, thinking that I should be relieved of this duty early." When it was the son's turn, Imam instructed his own son, Muhammad ibn Hanafiya, to hold the pitcher and wash the guest's hands. Looking at his son, Imam said, "I washed your father's hands. My son washed your hands. If your father had not been my guest today, I would have washed your hands myself. But Allah loves to see this. When a father and a son are present in a place, the father enjoys privilege and a priority."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله dear audience welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Mousavi and what we do in this program is to talk about different religious themes that we can take out of the stories that you listen to and then try to make use of them in our daily lives as Muslims. Well, our subject for today is about the status of father in Islam. Imam Rida alayhi salam says, "It is obligatory to do good to one's parents, even though they are polytheists. But in disobeying God, one should not be commended by them." A man named Ibrahim, who was one of the companions of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, said to him, "My father is very old and incapacitated, so that when he wants to do the basics of his life, we take him on our shoulders and take him away." Imam alayhi salam said, "If you can do such a thing yourself and make food for him with your own hands, because such a service is the shield of fire for the day after your resurrection." Therefore, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam recommends that children take care of their parents when they get old and weak, just as they did when the children were young and weak. The establishment of homes for the elderly, it can be justified today if they are ill, poor, homeless, lonely, or those elders who want to live in such homes themselves. However, it is very bad and painful that some children and grandchildren use these homes to reach their selfish desires and force their old parents and grandparents to leave home and go live in such places. Okay, for now, let's go for a short break and we will be back in no time.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Welcome back, dear audience. Muhaqqiq al-Ardabili, who was one of the greatest Shia scholars, said, "It is reasonable to say that one should avoid being damned by his parents. Traditions and Quranic verses also support this. Children must be their parents. The jurisprudents have stated that if the leader has not declared holy war or the infidels have not attacked Muslim lands, parents can prevent the children from going to war." Whatever is forbidden or incumbent upon one regarding strangers also holds for parents. Some of the rights of the father over his children are that. First, one cannot travel without the permission of his parents. 2. One must be his parents. 3. Parents can prevent one from participation in war. 4. If one is to be his parents or say his prayers, he should put off the prayers and do what his parents ask him to do. And 5. There are times when parents can prevent one from attending the congregational prayer. You know, these are the rights of a father and his children. As we look at Islam and its view through narrations, we see that the value and importance they place on parents is very high and only a step lower than Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. A place that if people seek redemption and heaven, they are given blessed and their goodness to parents. We hope that in this way, we can be benevolent children for our parents and models for other Muslims. Thank you very much, dear listeners. It seems that we have no more time for this episode. And until another episode, I bid you farewell. And may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And talking about the virtues of Imam Ali alayhi salam is Imamul Afin, Imam Ali, the Imam of the forgivers, those who forgive.
Yes, he was the first Imam. He was the first successor of Rasulullah. But he shares also many other firsts in the history of not only Islam, but also of the world of creation.
Imam Ali ruled with justice and treated all of the people of the society as equals, regardless of their fame or position.
Rasulullah himself told us where he addressed Ali, he says, Ya Ali, he says, nobody will ever come to know the true nature or who Allah is except for you and I. And nobody will ever know the true nature of Rasulullah, as the Prophet himself said, except for two, Allah and Ali. And then Rasulullah says that none will ever know you, Ali, except for two individuals, myself being Rasulullah, and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
We are inshallah loving Imam Ali and Ahlul Bayt and trying to follow their footsteps to expand our world.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.